what, sorry?
The gender gap.
Okay. So I guess it's nice to put this work in context. For the exhibition, I made this two-channel film, and there's also two off-site projects. One of them is a series of five billboards, which were around North Hackney Park. And one of them is now here in the gallery, and the other four will be in the park for another week or more. And then also for the exhibition, there's a tour this afternoon of the Botanic Gardens by a caterpillar vehicle. And so these three things together make up the various orbits of the exhibition. Which seems appropriate because my experience in Christchurch has always been to come here for a very short time and respond to the city by making a small work and then heading away again and never really spending a great deal of time here. So it was nice to turn that experience into the process for making the work and feeling like I have this kind of circling of Christchurch and it has this pull of gravity, and when I get here I see a very small part of it and then I get flung away again. Maybe that's just the experience of being an artist these days, but it's nice to include that kind of feeling of physics into making the work. Mm-hmm. So where to from here? What would you, if there are any questions about the making of this work or the content of it, or I can talk a little bit about general background into things in general.
Mm-hmm. And I'd asked her that before it started too, and then I said, no, tell us now.
I can save that. Well, I guess maybe it's important for me to mention that this is the first time I've really shown video. Mm-hmm. I've made a couple of really short pieces before, but they were just made on an iPhone and without a tripod, and they were kind of tests. It feels like quite a foreign medium to me, but because I'm so interested in time, and our experience of time, it seemed silly not to engage with video because I guess filmmaking is like pure duration, right? So to ignore that in a practice that is interested in time seems quite silly.
Have you been working with photography
though? No, not at all. I guess if I were to nominate a particular process, I'd say that I make sculpture or work in a spatial way.
And but that's sculpture, isn't it? You know, in a way, looking at that.
And they certainly look like sculptures.
Mm, and I think the parts of both of these sites that I was really interested in is the buildings and the histories of the buildings. So for me, it's still this kind of spatial attention to what's going on and allowing the stories of built structures to tell the history of a place, because I think that there's so much in the design and the use and the reuse and the repurposing of these buildings that says a lot about how our appreciation and our of those sites changes over time. And when I'm at Mount John at the observatory, there are some buildings that are no longer used, which are kind of catalogued in the work, no longer used for what they were built for, because that technology is, you know, no longer needed, or you know, they don't need a dark room to fix the seismographic readings anymore, so they don't use that for that anymore, of course. But those are the spaces that I'm most interested in because I want to see what those traces look like and how it now gets used. And
you'd be probably one of the only people going to the end of the buildings instead of the out front.
yeah, exactly. And think any kind of request to go inside the seismic hut was really met with a kind of like, why would you bother? It's not very interesting in there. I can take you inside all of these other interesting buildings instead, so I can show you the equipment. And one of the questions which is even in the soundtrack for this is one that I took with me to Mount John is, what does observation look like? Because we so often see the results of this kind of observation, and we see footage of what the stars look like and really incredible, you know, time-lapse photography of the night sky moving over observatories, and see, you know, sometimes you see the telescopes moving around, but you never really get to see the space in which those observations are made, and the working space. And I think one of the biggest interests for me in the practice generally is studying tools and studying what people make to make life easier, or how design can change people's everyday lives in this really small way, whether that's kind of approached from a scientific view and these kind of tools that are used for physics and astronomy and science, or whether it's an archaeological view of objects that have come down to us over hundreds or thousands of years that we sometimes know the use of and sometimes we don't, we can speculate. But certainly working out how tools affect our lives and what tools people find useful and how they reuse things in different ways or use things in ways that they weren't intended to be used. I think that says a lot about how we live and how we think. And so I'm definitely interested in tools above any other kind of human activity. This shot here is of two people recalibrating and studying the gravity base station, which is in the workshop in Hagley Park in the Botanic Gardens. And it's kind of travelled slightly over time, apparently. That base was built so that an accurate magnetic survey of New Zealand could be taken, because at that stage they didn't really have a clear idea of how it all worked in the southern hemisphere, and they needed that, and that kind of equipment was used to calibrate ships' navigation instruments, for example.
And the work through the next part of the gallery, that's yours, isn't it?
No, that's James Beckett's work.
James who?
James Beckett. So I think there's a nice similarity in approach between his work and mine, but it certainly wasn't... I think neither of us knew about that connection when the work was being made. But yeah, a nice approach we have in common, I guess, is studying these ways of dealing with the landscape and the environment that certain groups have, and kind of presenting that in a way that more audiences can see. Something that's maybe not necessary for the reading of the work, but something that's nice for me to pass on, is that the observatory, this is the second time that I've been to visit there. But I've known about this observatory for my whole life, because some relatives of mine have worked there for a very long time. And so I've always wanted to go there and to see it, and as I say, in a kind of artistic capacity, to see how observation looks and to find out what looking at stuff looks like, basically. But it was also really important for me to do this for Christchurch, because it's nearby. It's, you know, 3 hours drive from here, so it feels very close to Christchurch as a city. But also because my aunt and uncle, who have lived in Tekapo for 30 years or more and have lived on the mountain since the mid-90s, as resident superintendents and as observers and technicians. After a really long period, they're about to retire and move off the mountain. And as a field station of the University of Canterbury, I think they've got two others, one at Kaikoura and one elsewhere. The university, of course, is constantly reviewing how useful these things are, how much research comes out of them. I don't think that the astronomy and physics department is one that has a lot of masters and PhD students coming out of it at the moment. So I think the university, constantly check out how viable something like this is. And it was really important for me. This is the year before the 50th anniversary of the observatory, to go up there and see it and to document it while I have this personal connection with the work that goes on there. and before my relatives moved away.
Because they've just sent out an email, it may be this weekend or sometime soon,
mm-hmm.
inviting people, you had to book in and then you could go for a weekend with the alumni, you know, mm-hmm. of the university. So you didn't go with them, did you?
No.
But it's funny that that's because it's an anniversary, maybe.
Yeah, next year, I think in May, they're celebrating with a kind of symposium. I mean, for 10 years, the observatory has been really accessible to the public. Before the observatory was set up in the mid-60s, it was part of a sheep station, so the university leased it then. This top of the hill for the purpose of setting up an observatory. It was actually led by the University of Pennsylvania, and since the 90s, it's had a lot of involvement from the University of Nagoya and one in Osaka. Because the clarity of the air there, the altitude, the number of nights per year when there's no cloud cover, so you can do photometric work, it's just a pretty special location. There was various site testing done around New Zealand to establish that particular location for the observatory, and actually my uncle, who is currently the superintendent, when he was 14 or 15, was involved in the site testing here and in other places in the South Island, so he's really seen the observatory from its very earliest days up until the present. It's still a mystery to me, a lot of what goes on there, and I've never been super scientifically minded, but they do have a lot of public outreach there, and a lot of people know the observatory and know what goes on there because they're quite open and willing to engage with the public.
Could you talk a little bit about the voiceover?
Sure.
About the text?
Yeah. It's a part two to one of the other videos that I've made in terms of that voiceover. The first one came out of earlier this year. I was doing a residency in Paris and was thinking about that space that I was working in, and also a space in Melbourne that I had shown in previously, where a friend of mine was then showing, and he had previously had the same residency room. And so thinking about the way that air can circulate or become dense or move between different spaces, and I'm really interested in ways that both time and location might be mixed up and swapped, and ways of disrupting our understanding of particular spaces and times of only being, you know, parallel, never existing on top of one another. So I started writing about how this air, perhaps, in the room was growing dense and following me around and becoming this presence, and then maybe it wasn't air anymore but something else that I couldn't name, but this feeling of having something just outside of view or outside of articulation, basically something that sits around as a thought that won't define itself. And I guess also there's this process which comes out a lot in writing of once you name something, it becomes very defined, and so maybe there's a strategy creatively where you don't want to name something, because once you've named it, it stops being open and stops being productive, or that thing ends when you name it. So possibly there's this game of not naming something, of thinking about something without ever naming it or defining it, and seeing where that can go. But time, I guess, and our concept of time is one of those tools that we were talking earlier about tools and my interest in them. I think, yeah, our kind of shared understanding of what time is and clock time and the calendar are the tools that I'm really most interested in. How these things can structure our lives and how we might work against that, because we're so good at programming our time to get the most out of it, but then as soon as you schedule yourself to, you know, all of the useful hours of your day, you suddenly feel like you're losing that time. The more attention you pay to your time, the more like you feel you don't have any. So if there are these gentle ways to slow time down or work against productive, useful time or chronological time and try and impose a new kind of understanding of time in our lives, I'm quite interested in how we might do that.
Yeah, so am I. I almost went with the university and that was all. Yeah, but that's one of my goals too.
That might be the little foot in the door that I needed.
Excellent. Well, now you know a little bit about what it looks like, so
yeah.
You can
experience it's quite funny that I think.
It's also a strong link with this because the that work, while the text was again about this kind of this unnameable thing that accompanies you through life, that was focused on a particular building which I wasn't able to go into, but I knew about, which is the International Bureau of Weights and Measures, and that's the building just outside of Paris at Sèvres, where the famous porcelain manufactory is, in a kind of a national park, parkland, you know, French-style park, very manicured, fake wildlife, all of that. And in this building, they hold the original, one of the original prototypes of the meter, and also the international prototype of the kilogram. And so the idea that there are these metal objects, they're both cast, platinum iridium alloy. These objects are sitting in this building, and they're the ones that all of the other ones in the world are based on. I mean, they have kind of these secondary and tertiary other kind of Czech versions that are taken from those. And so there are some in, you know, all around the world. There's one, there's a meter in the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam that I got to see as well, and volumetric measures. But the idea that there's this measurement is a concept, just like time is a concept. But the fact that you could go and possibly see or touch, smell or hear the original of that, you know, the physical manifestation of these intangible ideas, I was really fascinated by that. And I wrote to the International Bureau and said, is it possible to come and see these objects? And they said no. And so, of course, I went there and walked around the perimeter of the grounds and tried to get in, and just wanted to be on the same site as these objects. I mean, they're quite friendly, but what they do there, I mean, they're not a museum, they're an international scientific organization. They're in charge of making sure that all of the meters are the same and all of the kilograms are the same, and that there are all types of international standards that get far more abstract and than that and specialised in that, but those are kind of products of the French Revolution that continue to be so important in our lives today and all around the world. But they were very kind and wrote back to me and explained that the objects are in a vault, in a cellar, in a cave, as they call it in French. And to go into the cave requires three different people to be present with their keys. Only three keys that can get you in there. And one of them is the head archivist of France, one of them is the director of the building, and one of them is the director of their governance building, of their governance organisation, and he lives in Australia. And so they only open the cave once a year, and that's because the statute of their organisation says that they have to do that to check that the objects are still there.
And the public allowed them then?
No. Obviously, you know, these objects, they're so like scientifically precise, and so things like changes in temperature. Well, no, I think recently, like in the last few years, it's been discovered that the kilogram's getting lighter.
Whoa. Wow.
And so, of course, for all of us. But see, this is one of those great... One of those great questions. I mean, the meter is now like that the meter that they've got in the cave is not the official meter anymore. They've figured out a kind of, you know, atomic frequency based system for what the meter is. It's, you know, it's the distance travelled by certain photons in a certain, you know, over a certain length of space. It's very precise, but the kilogram, and there's a lot of it's quite divisive in like the metrology community. The kilogram has not yet been recalibrated in a way that can be done other than weighing this object which exists in the cave. And for some reason, and they're not quite sure what it is, but it seems to be changing. And so the mass of this object is changing, and therefore the weight of it is changing. And I love this question of like, if that's what all the standards are tied to, then does that mean if the kilogram gets lighter, then all of the other kilograms are off? Or do we have to follow that one, or does that one become obsolete?
Yeah.
And obviously it makes sense that one is obsolete, and there's a different way of measuring that becomes a standard, and that's what people are really going for, but it just hasn't happened yet. So our kilogram's just slowly getting lighter.
It really highlights, isn't it, the things that you think are a fixed state. There's nothing like easy things.
Yeah. And that's where like this interest in measurement lies for me, is that, you know, we know that it's completely constructed. We know that clock time is completely constructed. It's something that we use because we can all agree on it, and that makes life easier. But when you start questioning our experience of those kinds of measurement, everything suddenly is up for grabs.
Did you like maths at school or anything like
no,
that?
No, I'm terrible at maths. Not good at science either. No, I think they probably have metrology geeks that want to come in and see it all the time, and that they just can't. They don't have the resources to be able to.
You were like up against the kings of red tape.
It's true, the home of bureaucracy. Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's important to remember that you don't have to understand it to approach some of these questions. Like, they're really philosophical questions. It's not all about the science. And if you don't have a kind of philosophical and ethical basis for science, then maybe the data doesn't end up being that useful, or can very easily be skewed. So I mean, it's really nice to speak to people at observatories and figure out what they do and speak to them, because they enjoy sharing that also. And an exchange of that information on what they do can be held in a way that's not necessarily academic and at a high level of knowledge in that field.
Speaking in the banner, and he said, yes, but this can also just mean large.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is the thing.
Yeah, and of course being preceded by the word hyperbolic, which we, you know, when we talk about hyperbole, but in fact hyperbolic is to do with the shape of an orbit. And so it takes on this nice double, you know, of course we're talking big, we're talking really big, we're abstracting science. But it's also very grounded and concrete. And it's nice to, again, it's nice to go in a really uneducated way into a field like this, which is very specialized, because then you can see the poetry in their language.
Mm-hmm.
And when you visit another field outside of your own expertise, you have that ability to not know what all the words mean, and then you can change them and change how they mean. Yeah. Well, that's how we make any world, isn't it? You just build it yourself.
Mm.
Yeah.
Any other questions people might have? If not, maybe that's a nice place to end.
Mm.
Think about these problems. Thanks, Ash.
Thank you.
It's like this vehicle that goes through the park, and you just sit on it, and it drives you around. That's
Has it got a trailer or something?
Yeah, it's like a 10-seater, and then they've got a 10-seater trailer. And you can roll down the sides.
Is it what they take people round and to view the gardens?
Yeah, you can like do a little tour.
Yeah. Oh, fun. Yeah. And it's 4 o'clock at the Tourist Information Centre.
That's right.